From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Follow the dollars. Rudy Giuliani tells Sean Hannity that President Trump did, in fact, reimburse his lawyers for hush money paid to Stormy Daniels.
It's not campaign money. No campaign finance violation.
So they funneled it through the law firm.
Funneled through the law firm, and the president repaid it.
Also, showdown at the border. Asylum seekers from Central America say, yes, we could. And this week at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, comedian Michelle Wolf takes heat for roasting multiple targets in Washington, including the press, President Trump, and Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
I actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts. And then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the latest White House drama? Rudy Giuliani's story about Trump lawyer Michael Cohen's hush money payment. Special counsel Robert Mueller's list of questions for the president. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from Washington is Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Kimberly, great to have you back on Point. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Aaron, great to have you back with us as well.
It's great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Anthony, Kimberly, and Aaron.
Great to have all of you here. So let's jump right in with these shifting explanations from the White House about who knew what when about hush money that President Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, paid to Stephanie Clifford, also known as Stormy Daniels, who claims to have had an affair with President Trump. Just a little background to catch listeners up here. Trump has denied the affair. He has previously denied covering the cost of this hush agreement. But this week, Rudolph Giuliani, now a Trump lawyer, told Fox News that the president indeed did reimburse Cohen for the payments to Daniels. And just yesterday, he said, Giuliani said, Trump only recently found out about it. Kimberly, I'll start with you. What's the takeaway from all this? This has created sort of new levels of disarray, I guess, around messaging from the White House.
It really has. I mean, it started by way of the fact that Rudy Giuliani, who joined Trump's personal legal team, made this announcement in a series of media appearances without giving anyone in the White House a heads up. It seems to be a strategy that he and the president came up with themselves and executed and really took everyone, including the press secretary, by surprise by saying, yes, indeed, the president did reimburse Michael Cohen for these payments made to Stormy Daniels. As to why they took this approach after denying anything that the president had anything to do with it so far, there are a couple of theories. One was that it might have been a signal to Michael Cohen, who is under investigation, to say, hey, look, we're going to take this on the chin for you. You hold tight and don't flip and cooperate with federal investigators. It could also mean that they know that Robert Mueller and his team knows that the president paid these payments and they're trying to get out ahead of it and tell the truth about it now so that later that doesn't drop. But it was definitely a cause of some confusion and consternation among White House staff.
Yeah, and it's creating, I guess you could say, the same kind of confusion in the White House press room. So here's a little bit of tape from yesterday's White House press briefing. Reporters confronted Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, about Rudy Giuliani's admission that the president did repay the lawyer for hush money given to Stormy Daniels. Here's a bit of a testy exchange between Sanders and CNN's Jim Acosta.
You said on March 7th there was no knowledge of any payments from the president, and he's denied all of these allegations. Were you lying to us at the time, or were you in the dark?
The president has denied and continues to deny the underlying claim. And again, I've given the best information I had at the time. Yeah.
Given the best information I had at the time. Aaron Blake, let me come to you. I mean, Kimberly raised such an intriguing question. Why? I mean, what's the strategy behind what Giuliani was trying to accomplish here?
I think that Kimberly raised a couple of good theories about this. I'm not as convinced that this was a giant gaffe as some people are. I think another potential reason for the disclosure would be, you know, the Trump team is very much interested in arguing that communications between the president and Michael Cohen were privileged because of attorney-client privilege. Well, in order for that to be the case, Michael Cohen has to have been acting as a lawyer rather than as a friend. And if he was doing this without Trump's knowledge, without getting reimbursed, that's much more difficult to argue about attorney-client privilege. And so, you know, it may have been hatched a little bit hastily. It may not have included other people in the White House, and they may be upset about that. I'm not sure that this necessarily changes a whole lot, more so than just proving that they don't have their ducks in a row and that there's not a whole lot of coordination when it comes to defending the president.
Listeners, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join our discussion about the week's news. Let's go to Clay. He's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Clay, good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. The special counsel was given the task of investigating whether Trump asked for Russian help to win the election. And now it seems the investigation has veered sharply off course. So my question is, surely he wasn't told to get Trump any way he could, or was he?
So, Clay, are you referring to why the focus on Giuliani's statement about the hush money, for example? I mean, why are we focusing on that? Kimberly, take a stab at responding to Clay here.
Yeah. So when a special counsel is appointed, they are tasked with an assignment, as you said, in this case, to sort of get to the bottom of Russian interference with the election. But they also have the authorization that if they come across evidence of other crimes, to either investigate that if it stems from this investigation or to refer it to another investigatory authority. For example, what we saw with Michael Cohen when federal investigators in New York conducted the search on his home and office. So it's not unusual for a special counsel to find something other than they originally were set out to do. For example, if you remember in the Bill Clinton case, that initial investigation was not about Monica Lewinsky, but ultimately that's where the perjury was found in testimony that President Clinton gave about Monica Lewinsky. So it's within the power of the special counsel to find things other than the original task.
Right. And it's worth noting, and I want to play another piece of tape from Rudy Giuliani, that he made reference to the firing of FBI Director James Comey in his interview with Fox News. And of course, the firing of Comey was what led to the appointment of a special counsel. So here's, excuse me, here's Rudy Giuliani providing what sounds like another explanation for why the president fired Comey.
He fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say that he wasn't a target of the investigation. He's entitled to that. Hillary Clinton got that. And he couldn't get that. So he fired him and he said, I'm free of this guy.
Jack Beatty, what do you hear in that? Does this sound like a shifting explanation to you? And what's the significance of that?
Well, it's a shifting emphasis, that's for sure. It's Russia-related, but it's what did Mr. Trump say with his interview with Lester Holt? He said, this Russia thing. I fired him because of this Russia thing, this, you know, this phony story about Russia. So this fits generally under that rubric, I guess. It doesn't seem in that sense so glaring a contradiction, but it is a new emphasis. And this shifting stories and the sort of how this keeps happening on topic after topic related to this. This comes the week that the Washington Post published a scorecard, really, of Trump's falsehoods, misrepresentations, lies, call it what you will. And he's up now to 3,000. That's about 6.5 a day. And, you know, this is a wholesale attack on the truth, on the even the idea of truth. And it comes in the same week that Michael Hayden, former CIA director, quoted somebody saying, you know, post-truth is pre-fascism. That is, if you give up on the idea of truth, the truth can be anything the leader says. And seemingly out there in America, there are lots of people who are willing to just, you know, suspend, you know, forget what their lying eyes are telling them and believe Trump, even though repeatedly his stories change. And people who go out in front for him, like Sarah Sanders, are made to look like liars, and on it goes.
Mm. I want to move on to another subject this week, and that is what we learned at first in the New York Times about a list of questions that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, wants to ask President Trump. We also learned that the specific questions were actually created by one of Trump's lawyers, Jay Sekulow, so they were his interpretation of 16 specific subjects presented by Mueller's team. Let me come to you, Aaron, on this. What's the significance of what we learned about these questions and about how they became public?
Yeah, so I think the questions in total weren't terribly surprising. A lot of them had to do with what did you know about this, you know, event that we already knew was really important, and what were you thinking about at the time? What did you do in response? How involved were you in these things? A lot of it was getting at that and goes over events that are presently known. I do think there were some hints at things that we don't know about that haven't been reported by the press so far. One was when Mueller was apparently interested in Paul Manafort related to collusion, asking about the Michael Flynn firing decision having to do with the Trump tweet. So I think there were a number of things that shed some new light on things that we may learn about going forward.
Aaron, good. Hold that thought. We're coming up against a break. We're going to continue the conversation about this particular subject when we return. Listeners, we're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling hopeful about a deal with North Korea? Nancy Pelosi says she'll run for speaker if Democrats take back the House. Is it time for new leadership for the Democrats? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. Do you support reducing U.S. troops in South Korea? Do you support Nancy Pelosi's announcement that she'll run as House Speaker if the Democrats take back the House? Are you surprised that Scott Pruitt continues to hold on as EPA Secretary despite growing ethics concerns? With me are Kimberly Atkins from the Boston Herald, Aaron Blake from the Washington Post, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And Kimberly, let me come to you. Aaron, before the break, was talking about this list of questions from the special counsel, Robert Mueller. What do you think the questions tell us about what kind of jeopardy the president is facing? Does it tell us, does it give us anything, any new insight into that question?
Well, I think the biggest insight it shed is the fact that it is continuing to look at the president's words and actions in an attempt to see if there was any obstruction or continues to be efforts to obstruct the investigation into Russian meddling. I mean, one of the questions is even the discussions that the president had or his attempts to try to fire Robert Mueller, something that White House counsel Don McGahn apparently thwarted. The special counsel is looking at that, too. So it really sheds light that everything that the president is saying, doing, tweeting is still under the radar of this investigation. And I wanted to make one other point, too, about what we were talking earlier about Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen and what the special counsel is looking into. We don't have any evidence that the special counsel is looking at all into the payments that the president made to Stormy Daniels. That's something separate. And in fact, the one thing that Michael Cohen is being investigated for, that was something the special counsel transferred to New York prosecutors to handle. That's not being handled by the special counsel itself. So I know it's a lot of things in the news and it's confusing. And there's this, you know, this convergence of different legal, illegal issues that the president is involved in. But that's not a special counsel investigation.
All right. Good point. I'm glad you made that distinction. Let's take a couple of callers. Peter is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Peter, good to have you. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for my call.
Sure.
I want to know, at what point, I mean, how much leeway do you give potential criminal suspects to constantly change their story, you know, to come up with so-called different legal strategies, legal angles? I mean, we're treating this like it's some kind of a, like a football game or something, like, what's the coach going to do this time, you know, change the strategy up, bring in a new assistant coach. I mean, at what point does it just become, look, this is just false, this is baloney, this guy's lying, he's doubled back on what he said numerous times, and Congress steps in and does something about it? I mean, a regular run-of-the-mill citizen that were to lie and change their stories this much to prosecutors or to police would be promptly arrested, thrown in jail, and would be awaiting trial. How come these guys get away with it?
Well, Peter, I'm sure you express the frustrations of a lot of people out there, but I mean, it has to be said, President Trump hasn't answered questions under oath yet. He's perhaps the target of an investigation. We don't even know that. So we're talking really about political spin. But Aaron Blake, do you want to respond to Peter's sort of frustration out there and the question that he asks?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the fact is that, you know, these statements and these shifting explanations that the White House has repeatedly offered, if these were offered in interviews with Robert Mueller's team, they would be in very big trouble. And just because they're not being offered in that setting, though, doesn't mean this doesn't play into the case. If you look back at the Bill Clinton investigation, the Starr report that was issued, part of the case that had to do with obstruction of justice had to do with Bill Clinton's public comments about this. Those can go towards intent to deceive. Those can go towards obstruction, even if they, you know, by themselves are not under oath and can't be considered perjury or false statements. So if you look at the list of questions that Jay Sekulow put together and that the Mueller team is apparently interested in, there are some indications that they are interested in what Trump said publicly, what discussions were being had behind the scenes. And I think all of that is about piecing together an entire narrative of whether the president was trying to hide the truth from the American people, but also from the investigators. And so, you know, I don't think a shifting, you know, narrative, shifting explanations from the White House are necessarily punishable criminally on their face. But taken as a whole, they could work against what the White House is trying to accomplish, and they could work against the president.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the possibility of if Special Counsel Mueller has the opportunity to sit down and ask questions directly of President Trump. So here's Ty Cobb. He's the lawyer who plans to leave his position on President Trump's legal team at the end of the month. He spoke to ABC's Jonathan Carl and Rick Klein on their Powerhouse Politics podcast yesterday. Carl and Klein asked Cobb whether the president would sit down for an interview with Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Here's what he said.
It's certainly not off the table, and people are working hard to make decisions and work toward an interview. And assuming that can be concluded favorably, there'll be an interview.
Jack Beatty, what do you think about that, the possibility of such an interview and what such an interview would yield?
Well, it seems that that may be yesterday's counsel. What one reads is that the president is not going to go ahead with an interview and is going to make the special counsel go to court to secure his presence, and that gets into a long fight. But you can see why his lawyers, the new ones even, would be chary of having Mr. Trump talk to the special counsel. You know, sort of as prelude to that, someone looked at his deposition that he gave a few years ago on some matter in New York. And in the course of just, I think, that one deposition, there were 30 false statements, something like that. And the president simply can't breathe, it seems, without saying something that isn't true. Now, it raises the question, does he know he's lying, or does he just make reality up as he goes along? We don't know that. We don't know the degree of his moral culpability or his semi-derangement of what truth and reality is, but it would be very risky indeed to have him talk.
Mm. Jack, Aaron, Kimberly, I want to move on and talk about North Korea. So let's move on to the big foreign news story this week. The South Korean government said this week that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said he would abandon his nuclear weapons if the U.S. formally agrees to end the Korean War and promise not to invade this his country. The Trump administration is talking cautiously about reaching a deal with North Korea ahead of a planned meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. But Jack, let me stick with you. What are you seeing here? Does this look like a real possibility of something significant happening on the Korean Peninsula, or is Washington being played by North Korea? What do you see here?
Well, some people think it is being played because the president seems to have given things up without getting anything in return. For example, the meeting that was a concession without, thus far, any yield from the North Koreans. Now, perhaps the release of these prisoners would be that yield. But you know, this is happening, this promising movement with North Korea, just at the moment when the president is moving the other way with Iran. I mean, he's about to scrap the Iran deal. And while he's saying to the North Koreans, I want to make a deal with you, but they can quite rightly say to him, well, wait now, if you're ripping up the Iran deal because it doesn't suit you,
what's a deal with us going to be worth?
Exactly. Right. So he's in contradiction there, his policies strategically, one with the other.
Well, a couple of calls on this subject. Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Clarksville, Tennessee. Matt, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I believe the North Korea deal is done and over with, and the rest of it's for show. Trump made his play. China's backing him, and the world is tired of the regime and North Korea's antics, and all the rest of it's going to be for show.
So it doesn't sound like then you have a lot of faith in what South Korea said Kim Jong-un said about giving up his nuclear weapons.
Now, he'll give them up. I believe he'll give them up. This is not just for show, not one bit.
Got it. Matt, thanks so much for the call. Let me move on to Tim, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Tim, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. I do believe that this is all for show. I believe that they're trying to buy some time to facilitate the process of getting a new testing site, seeing how the last one kind of imploded on them. I don't think that the South Koreans are acting in their best interest because I believe they're acting out of fear. They're so intimidated by the North Koreans and what might happen if they were attacked that they're willing to take anything this guy says on its face, as opposed to really looking at the history and his conduct as a whole throughout the regime's control over North Korea, his father included. And I don't think that the Trump administration is or can do anything to change anything about North Korea. I think that China would probably have to step in and do what it needs to do. North Korea has absolutely no interest in giving up their nukes. If they were going to do it, they would have done it a long time ago. In fact, they would have never developed them in the first place.
All right, Tim, thanks for that. Aaron, let me come to you and get you to chime in here. I mean, all this, of course, is happening while the Trump administration is preparing, we think, for a meeting with Kim Jong-un. They might well meet in the truce village in the demilitarized zone where the leaders of the two Koreas met recently. But what do you think? For show? Something real happening here? Trump being played? How do you view this?
Well, the fact is we're dealing with a situation in which it really depends upon probably four people, including the leaders of China and South Korea. And two of those people happen to be extremely unpredictable, prone to kind of flying off the handle, saying very threatening things. Speaking, of course, about Trump and Kim Jong-un, we just don't know where this is going to lead. But I will say that even experts who have been generally skeptical of the president's foreign policy have seen progress here. They think that the sanctions that were put in place against North Korea were a big success story. Of course, Nikki Haley had a big role in that at the UN. Getting China to the table has played a role here. We don't know about the nuclear testing site and what role that has played, whether that's why North Korea is suddenly willing to deal. We don't know if it's because they suddenly have the capability that they've been looking for all these years and feel like this is the time to negotiate something with that. And we don't know exactly what kind of a hard line the Trump administration is going to take here. But I think it is worth, you know, saying that we're probably further in this process than we've been in a long time, maybe including in 2000 when there were serious peace talks. But, you know, predicting an outcome at this point on either side is a very difficult thing to do, especially because of the main two characters involved here.
So sticking with North Korea for a moment, there's a tweet from President Trump saying that we're doing very well with the hostages, referring to three Americans held in North Korea. He says the U.S. is in constant contact with North Korea. He adds that at a time and location has been set for the summit with Kim Jong-un. And yesterday, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders talked about, wouldn't confirm, the possible release of U.S. detainees from North Korea. Here's what she said.
We think that that would be an incredible sign of goodwill and certainly a great statement for the North Koreans to make ahead of the summit and the discussions.
Kimberly Atkins, before we move on to other stories this week, I'd love to get your take on where we stand, where this administration stands with its initiative toward North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, I agree largely with what Aaron's already pointed out, that this was a very unusual approach to North Korea. Generally speaking, what we've seen is a lot of, you know, lower officials getting together on both sides, sort of setting up the groundwork for what could potentially be a higher level talk. And those higher level talks never end up panning out. This time, President Trump took the top-down approach and himself sought to speak to Kim Jong-un, and largely even people, as Aaron said, critical of his foreign policy has said, hey, if it brings him to the table, if it gets us closer, then it's a good opportunity. There's also a lot to risk giving Kim Jong-un this platform and really not getting anything back for it. The hostages could be a good point for that and sort of having something to negotiate for. But the thought that North Korea is going to give up their nukes after seeing what happened to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya or Saddam Hussein in Iraq after they agreed to give up their weapons. It just seems like a very high bar to clear.
Let's take a call on this subject. David is calling from Stanton, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. My point is this, and this is a theory, that when Un took his train trip to China, he was told by Ping in no uncertain terms that they're tired of propping them up, and that now that they have Trump, this useful idiot in the White House, they are going to take this opportunity to denuclearize and eliminate their burden of propping up North Korea. I think we should withdraw all of our troops from South Korea and Okinawa. We don't need them anymore. They're just a target if something did happen. So that's my theory, and it could be all wrong, but I think that China is the one that's putting the pressure on them to reach a denuclearization.
David, thanks so much for the call. We have a little bit of breaking news here. President Trump says U.S. troops withdrawing from South Korea is not on the table in any summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Jack, I'd love to get your take on this, because there was talk this week. The president talked about pulling troops out of South Korea. What do you think?
Well, that was consistent with the campaign rhetoric of his, and he wants the South Koreans, if our troops remain, to pay the full cost of keeping them there. But now he says that isn't on the table, removing them. I thought David's assessment of China's thinking was it sounded very shrewd, that China wants some resolution of this, but above all, they want some stability. They don't want chaos there, and a relaxation of sanctions and the chance to spread some butter in the North Korean economy, not just guns, would help bring about stability.
Listeners, we are talking about the week in the news. You can join the conversation. After the break, we'll take on the firestorm over the White House correspondence dinner, among other stories and your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. In other news this week, Arizona teachers ended their strike and will head back to the classroom. They gained a pay raise after a six-day walkout. Music teacher and organizer Noah Carvella says the fight is far from over.
We must stay the course now. We've won the first battle, but now we must win the war.
And watch out, Tinder. Facebook is getting into the dating game. Here's married father of two and CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Now, this is going to be for building real long-term relationships, all right? Not just hookups. It's going to be in the Facebook app, but it's totally optional. It's opt-in.
And leading the Tony Award nominations, Mean Girls and SpongeBob SquarePants. Here's SpongeBob opener Bikini Bottom Day.
Gary, it's me. To be here in the world renowned. Bikini Bottom, how I love this town. Bikini Bottom, when the sun shines down on a beautiful Bikini Bottom day.
I love it how SpongeBob SquarePants can brighten on any day. Listen, you can join the conversation. Were you offended by comedian Michelle Wolf's fiery roast at the Correspondents' Dinner in Washington? Is it time for that Washington tradition to end? My guests this hour, Kimberly Atkins from the Boston Herald, Aaron Blake from the Washington Post, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And folks, we are going to talk about that White House Correspondents' Dinner, but I want to just talk about some other politics first, closer to home, and look forward toward the midterm elections. Many Democrats are feeling confident about their chances to retake the House, but some are not so sold on the idea of returning Nancy Pelosi to the speakership. Pelosi told the Boston Globe this week, "We will win. I will run for speaker. I feel confident about it, and my members do too." But there are some Democrats running for the House who say they won't support Pelosi and want a new generation of leadership in the House, among them the newly elected Congressman Connor Lamb, who won an upset victory in Pennsylvania in March. Aaron, let me start with you. What's going on here? How big a divide does this represent for the Democrats?
Well, it's a very difficult situation for them because this is a strategy that has been used by Republicans to great effect for many years. If you look at the 2014 election, for instance, they had an unpopular president who much of the Republican Party base disliked very much. And if you look towards the end of that election, a lot of their advertising was focused not on him, but on Nancy Pelosi. And now we have a situation in which Nancy Pelosi says she wants to be speaker again. I don't think that's terribly surprising given that she's hung around for all these years when former speakers usually just retire after they're unseated. And so now, you know, Democrats are even more put in the position of answering the question of whether or not they would support her. And a lot of them are finding that to be a pretty easy question to answer, with the answer being no.
Let's take a call on this. We've got Pico, who's calling from Leesville, South Carolina. Pico, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, Nancy Pelosi has already been third in command of this country. I don't want to see her as Speaker of the House. I really think she ought to run for President of the United States.
And, wow.
I'd like to know what you think, and especially what Jack thinks about that possibility.
Well, I'm going to pass the buck to Jack right away. Jack, what do you think?
I think that would be ill-advised, just for the reason that Aaron said. I mean, the Republican Party has invested millions in organized vituperation against her, and that's just out there. That's just a constant. It's analogous, really, to Hillary Clinton. She had been demonized exorbitantly over decades, and that pretty much doomed her candidacy in 2016. People simply didn't trust her for real reasons, and partly for reasons that were responsive to all the Republican agitprop. So it would not be a good idea for her to run. And you know, you just get the impression that she's lost her way. I mean, maybe that's unfair to her. She's a very skillful legislator, and she rightly says we just can't have a bunch of white guys sitting around the table. But surely there's a woman or a minority in the House who could carry the baton farther, and who could really take the party into the modern age. I mean, there's a time for change, and it has arrived for the Democratic Party. And yet, when you look at the roster of potential candidates, you've got Bernie Sanders, you've got Joe Biden, you've got Elizabeth Warren. You know, you finally get down to a young person, Kamala Harris, who's in her early 50s. I mean,
and just sticking with the House, I mean, Pelosi, 78 years old. Minority Whip Steny Hoyer of Maryland, 78 years old. Assistant Democratic Leader James Clyburn of South Carolina, 77 years old. So, Kimberly, let me ask you, I mean, do these younger Democrats like Seth Moulton here in Massachusetts, Connor Lamb just elected in Pennsylvania, have a point that it might be time for some new blood at the top of the Democratic Party?
Well, a lot of members of the caucus think so. I mean, we saw in the last election of the speaker, a third voted for Tim Ryan of Ohio for the speakership. Nancy Pelosi still won handily, but it's a sign that her support within the caucus is slipping, and the Democrats are wrestling as the midterms approach and as 2020 approaches too, to sort of come up with a message that can appeal to voters, including young voters, and there is some deep concern that the old guard, so to speak, of septuagenarian leadership in the House is not the right way to move forward.
Mm. I want to move on quickly and stick with another and go to another story in Washington and ask both you, Kimberly and Aaron, about EPA Secretary Scott Pruitt, who remains in his job despite the fact that he remains under fire for a series of allegations around too cozy relationships with lobbyists and benefiting from those associations. Aaron, are you surprised that he's still Secretary of the EPA?
Yeah, I'm surprised for one big reason, and that's that there is really no end in sight for all of this. Scott Pruitt seems to have been operating without much of a regard for ethics rules or potential conflicts of interest. He doesn't seem to have cleared a lot of his decisions with ethics officials before he did them. He's now losing staff. I think maybe the most telling story this week, but beyond the big Washington Post report about how he had his trip to Morocco organized by a lobbyist, was that his top spokesman has left. Liz Bowman, who, by the way, in recent weeks has stepped aside from defending him for much of these things. She's kind of, according to the Post reporting, left that for another spokesperson, didn't feel comfortable defending him against these things. And we've also seen a number of other top staffers leave the agency. So once, you know, staff start leaving, once people don't want to defend you anymore, once we see these repeated disclosures and new reports from the media that make Scott Pruitt look even worse, you have to wonder what the purpose is of drawing this out any longer if eventually it's going to wind up in all likelihood in Scott Pruitt being out. But of course, this depends upon the whims of one person. And Donald Trump sees in Scott Pruitt a lot of the things he sees in himself, which is somebody who's being persecuted right now. Hmm. And so as long as Trump, you know, wants to continue to draw this out, that's what's going to happen.
Well, let's take a call on this. Larry is calling from Dixfield, Maine. Larry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for taking my call. I totally agree with what was just said. I'm seeing Scott Pruitt being probably the most unethical person I've ever seen in the EPA. And as they pointed out, we have another person who is even more unethical running the country. And I'm just concerned that right now we're seeing Trump's ego get in the way of diplomacy on the North Korean front. His ego is getting in the way of all of his campaign promises. And Pruitt is definitely the end product of his campaign promises. He said that he's going to get rid of all the environmental regulations. He's done that. And so my question is, when the Washington Post has all this information and all these things come out, and people hear this, all they hear is the fake news. And somebody pointed out before that all the fake news and coming from Trump is that one step like that is toward fascism. My question and concern is, how long do we put up with this before somebody stands in, steps up, and says, enough's enough? The people are being taken down the road of no return, and I'm just concerned that we are not seeing this end in sight that is not going to be pretty.
Larry, we got it, and thank you for the call. Kimberly, let me come to you. I mean, Larry's question is sort of wide open about lots of concerns around the Trump administration, but stick with the issue of Scott Pruitt. I mean, the question is, how long can he hold on? What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a question right now. I mean, think about just a little while ago when Tom Price's flying habits cost him his job as the head of Health and Human Services. It seems that things have changed, at least with respect to Scott Pruitt. But I think there is this. I think there's this new Trumpian approach to sort of hold firm and fight against your enemies when you are under fire. And I think so far as the president's concerned, he's happy with the job that Scott Pruitt's doing at EPA, as was discussed, really following through on all of the President Trump's campaign promises when it came to energy policy, really stepping away from actions to act against climate change and really ceding to what businesses wanted was just a big reduction in regulation. So right now that seems to be fine with him, and he doesn't particularly care how cozy he is with lobbyists. That's the one thing that goes against this campaign, of course, to drain the swamp.
Mm. Well, I want to move on and talk a little bit about last weekend's White House Correspondents' Dinner. As we know, comedian Michelle Wolf delivered a blistering routine that skewered the press, President Trump, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. We heard a little bit of tape from that at the top of the hour. So here's a little more where Wolf went after the media for their obsession with Trump.
He couldn't sell steaks or vodka or water or college or ties or Eric. But he has helped you. He's helped you sell your papers and your books and your TV. You helped create this monster, and now you're profiting off of him.
Wow. So that was some of the sharped, sort of barbed routine that Michelle Wolf offered at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Many believe it went too far. Margaret Talov of Bloomberg, the head of the White House Correspondents' Association, said Wolf's routine, quote, violated the spirit of the dinner. Kimberly, I want to come back to you. I understand you weren't there, but you were there for the after party. So you were sort of close to the reaction here. What did you think of that?
I mean, look, it's a comedian. I didn't find a lot of her jokes funny, but you know, that's par for the course for the White House Correspondents' Dinner. It's interesting. Yep. After at the after party, I was talking to someone at the White House about the jokes about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and the reaction really was, look, we were prepared for her to come for Sarah. We just think that with such a multitude of material that the joke just wasn't very original. And I thought that was an interesting take from the White House that I largely agreed with. But I think this discussion that we're having about the broader role of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, this idea about members of the media mingling with the folks that they're meant to cover and how it seems rather untoward. That's a conversation that's been happening for a long time. It will continue to happen so long as this dinner continues to happen. I am of the opinion that the press in Washington is responsible enough and is diligent enough to not let one night where you come together, break bread, and you know, jab at each other a little bit affect their reporting. I think the level of reporting you have seen from these organizations in Washington, a lot of Pulitzer Prize winning work, shows that is the case. They are certainly not afraid to report on this administration thoroughly and are not in danger of becoming sycophants.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. My following the response to Michelle Wolf's routine, the critical response by some, I was struck by the fact that, I mean, here's a comedian who was asked to deliver a roast. She did that. So to me, it seems strange that then she's called to task for doing just that. But Aaron Blake, let me throw sort of just two headlines at you. And this sort of gets to the point, the broader point that Kimberly was touching on. The Atlantic the quote, the slow, awkward death of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. New York Times, did Michelle Wolf kill the White House Correspondents' Dinner? I mean, is it time for it to go, or what do you think?
Yeah, this is something that reporters, as Kimberly talked about, have been kind of ambivalent about for a while now. You know, I've been to it before. I didn't go this year, but that wasn't a personal principle decision necessarily. I think there is – you can still do your job and still, you know, have a night like this, like Kimberly said. The Washington Post and the New York Times won Pulitzers for reporting very, very tough on the White House and the Russia investigation and other things having to do with the White House. But I do think it is, you know, there is a risk when people see the clip that you played here where there is an act that is largely making fun of the White House and roasting its inhabitants. And we hear a crowd that's largely full of journalists laughing about this, laughing repeatedly about an act that does poke fun at a Republican administration. And I think that alienates people. We have to acknowledge that, whether it's right or not, whether we can do our jobs or not, that there is an appearance problem here. And so I think this is a healthy discussion. I don't think this is a trivial discussion for us to be having, because we are in a position right now where a lot of the country doesn't trust what we do. And we have a responsibility to make sure that they trust what we do. And sometimes that involves making sure that, you know, even the appearance of a conflict of interest is not happening.
All right. Well, interesting point to end our discussion about the week's news on. Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us today. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
And Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for The Boston Herald. Same to you, Kim. Thank you for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, same to you. Thank you for being with us. Enjoy the Northwoods up there in New Hampshire.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Have a great weekend. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.